The answer, hopefully, is self-evident. But seeing the stairs I'm looking at, I think maybe I better say it. The right column drugs, because either A, they aren't as effective, or B, to be effective, there's a greater chance of some sort of side effect, or C, both of the above. Okay? Both of the above. That's why they're right column drugs. Either not as effective as what's the primary, or maybe there's some side effect issues, or both. And so we utilize them only when the primaries are not working. Okay? Just because the primary doesn't work doesn't mean that the right-hand column drug won't work. A little bit different shade of mechanism of action, maybe we'll get a more effective perspective. All right, so but just understand that. Here we go. And like I say, all of these have come out now since the mid-90s. And I'll just go through them rather briefly. Here we go. 96. By the way, you'll notice most of these come out in December. That's because the FDA panel for epilepsy usually meets in September and does its thing, and it's about a 6-day turnaround for the manufacturers to get up and cranking and release the drug. 96, the drug is topiramate. Topamax. Adjunct, it seems to have an effect on the sodium channel, works by that mechanism, seems to be able to increase the effectiveness of GABA, we're not exactly sure how, but something with the GABA receptor, but we're not as sure what, so we've got one, we got two, but in addition, and something we, whoa, should have said something. Something that we've been looking at since this came out is that this thing is an antagonist of glutamate receptors. Okay? Glutamate receptors. As GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, is the primary IPSP transmitter, so is glutamate a primary EPSP interneuron transmitter within the CNS. This is a not inhibitory, it tends to be an excitatory neurotransmitter. And where we've got a substance here that will antagonize glutamate receptors. Just as an aside, in our society, where do we commonly see glutamate utilized? How do we see it utilized? I'm sorry? That's a good one. That's close. Not quite there. Any ideas? No? Over 90, huh? Okay. It's called MSG. Hello. Which stands for monosodium glutamate. Hey, Rick. This is one of the good guys. His name's Rick. monosodium glutamate used to pop. It's a food additive, I guess you'd say, and it's used basically for tenderizing, and particularly in certain ethnic type of cooking, which is Chinese. And one of the things that I talk about in toxicology is Chinese restaurant syndrome. Now you guys are students, so you're in the pizza syndrome probably, but we're talking Chinese restaurant. You know, you pay your $8 for an all-you-can-eat buffet and you want to get your money's worth, right? Okay? Too much monosodium, that's an acute toxicity of glutamate. Excitatory, usually headaches, some other things going on. You get the idea, okay? Anyhow, topiramate tends to be an antagonist here at glutamate receptors, and perhaps that will have some utility as a mechanism of action for anti-epileptic drugs in the future. In 97 is first. December 97, Pyagabin, trade name here is Gabatril. This compound inhibits GABA reuptake and is best used again as an adjunct in partial seizures. Has a fairly decent side effect profile, usually either dizziness or depression being the major complaints in about 10 to 12% of patients. If it was more effective, and I mean if it had a better percentage of efficacy for the people that's tried it, it would probably move to be a frontline drug because of its good side effect profile. '98, the drug is Vigabatrin. Sabril is the trade name. Here's an irreversible inhibitor of GABA transaminase, which is a major degradatory pathway for GABA in the body. It tends to increase GABA levels. And again, best used for partial seizures. Biggest problem in the reason it has not been more popular is every once in a while you get a psychotic episode where a person's on it chronically. And the other thing about it that tends to work against it over the chronic long haul is that you gain weight with a fairly substantial amounts of weight. So long-term compliance has that kind of issue associated with it as well. Okay? And so that's probably on the back shelf somewhere. 2000. We see a Tegretol carbamazepine look-alike wannabe. Oxcarbazine or Trileptal. First carbamazepine look-alike to come on the market, and it basically is around because it has a lot less chance of aplastic anemia development, little or none. Severity is just maybe a mild agranulocytosis when it happens. There is less liver metabolism with this drug, and in terms of structure, there is no epoxide that comes out, so a lot less chance of liver toxicity as well. It's used a lot like Tegretol. It does not seem to have quite the efficacy that Tegretol has, so you tend to have this trade-off, less side effects but less efficacy. Also in 2000, we see this compound come on the market. market. Zonisamide is Zonagon. And the interesting thing about this compound is that what goes around comes around. Just a quick background for zonisamide. In the first couple of decades of the 1900s, we see the advent and development of the sulfa drugs, and they become a predominant anti-infective, antibacterial, or phytoestrogen until the advent of penicillin around World War II. Sulfa drugs. From the sulfa drugs, we come up with sulfonamide drugs, sulfonamides, in an attempt to increase the utility of these drugs by increasing their efficacy through pharmacokinetic means, put an amide on. So we see the sulfonamides. Interestingly enough, when we do that, we pretty much lose the antibacterial, anti-infective capability. But what comes out of it is the fact that sulfonamides tend to be diuretic for a number of reasons. And a number of the popular diuretic drugs that we call the thiazides are basically sulfonamide derivatives, hydrochlorothiazide being the most popular of those. Okay, but while we're dealing with that, we find out that sulfonamides are also capable of lowering elevated blood sugar. So another whole group of sulfonamides develops as anti-diabetic agents. And still another activity of some of the sulfonamides is inhibition of carbonic anhydrase. And so one of the sulfonamides, a compound called acetazolamide, becomes a popular drug for diuretic drug, blood pressure drug, because of its ability to inhibit carbonic anhydrase, and you start flushing drugs down the system, or drugs, or sodium down the system. Thiazides developed from acetazolamide, and a number of other things, but acetazolamide, interestingly enough, shows some anti-epileptic activity. And so for a period of about 5 to 10 years in the mid-1960s, we see acetazolamide being tried, and sometimes successfully, as an anti-epileptic. And then it falls into disfavor, the one thing Tegretol and valproic acid come on the market as alternatives to phenytoin, and so we got better choices. Acetazolamide goes to the back of the shelf. You can understand now where I'm going. Guess what this compound is? A derivative of acetazolamide. It is, in fact, a sulfonamide. It's a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. That's quite useful as an adjunct in partial seizure control. The big thing that we found with chronic utilization of this compound, zonisamide, is it tends to suppress appetite. Now, I'm not advocating it for weight control, but the problem is nutrition. People tend to have issues with nutrition when they're on this drug because they just don't like to eat. Okay? So that tends to be a problem. The other big thing is dizziness. Tends to be associated with a high incidence of dizziness. Not necessarily leading to nausea, but just in terms of being able to move around. So the compound has those issues. Last one. And we're going on. That's in the gate. Levetiracetam and its Keppra. again, another adjunct treatment, basically, and here's the segue to the next section. Chronic use of heparin is associated with all sorts of mental issues. All of the mood goes all over the map. Anxiety and depression may increase on one hand. On the other hand, you may suffer from hallucinations and psychotic development. On the other hand, you may become more irritable and aggressive, and rage behavior becomes an issue. Okay, so mood all over the map. High incidence of it, you don't know which way a person's going to go. So while it did have a little heyday, it has fallen somewhat into disfavor because the neurologist doesn't want to deal with the wide range of mood issues that are associated with drug. But that's the segue to the next section, which is all about mood. The antidepressants.
Try and do better. All those types of things
that kick in mentally that get you back onto an even keel. What happens with depression, however, is that somehow these are overridden and you start into a downward spiral, if you will. Which leads us to this disorder of mood that we call depression. Now, it used to be, when I was sitting in your seats, that when we talked about psychopharmacology, we had two categories. We had anxiety neuroses, the second column, anxiety neuroses, and we had psychoses, the first column. And the difference between the two, and I'll highlight this a little bit when we get to the psychotic column, is big difference between a neurosis and an anxiety neurosis kind of thing. How many of you, my head against the wall, that'll give me an insight into this depression. Howie Mandel, I keep saying you or Mobile. Howie Mandel, how many know the name? What's his neurosis? He's a germaphobe. So how does he shake hands? He doesn't. And he does one of these things, you know. Right? Okay. Neurotics know they have an issue. Know they have a problem. They won't walk under a ladder. They won't walk on a sidewalk crack. They have these little quirks. But they know they have them. They're a little bit odd. Psychotics, on the other hand, are really odd, and they don't know it. Their sense of reality is gone. And at one time, depression, severe depression, was a form of psychosis. It wasn't until the 1970s that it got its own column, that we recognized it as a separate mental issue other than being psychotic. So, for a long time, depression was treated to some degree with antipsychotic medications. We now know a whole different ballgame here. And depression is the major, in terms of incidence, major form of what we know now as a disorder of affect. That's A-F-F-E-C-T. Affect being the word for mood. So this is the major mood disorder. And there are two of them. Depression and bipolar disorder, otherwise known as manic depression, which we'll talk about on Friday a little bit. But by far and away, the greatest incidence is depression. And again, it is overriding these internal defenses to the point that your mood is going downhill. And we see both vegetative and non-vegetative signs, that is, biochemical, physiologic, that would be vegetative, versus mental, that would be non-vegetative signs and symptoms that this is occurring. The non-vegetative signs and symptoms first. An extreme sadness. Despondency. Woe is me. An emotional lability. Laban. That is, you laugh uncontrollably at, you know, stuff that really isn't fun. You cry over the littlest thing. You're all over the map. Emotional lability.
A lot of people are saying, God, maybe I'm depressed.
a feeling of hopelessness. feeling of guilt, worthlessness. The world would be better off without me. God made a mistake when he put me on earth. Those types of issues. Okay? These are all non-vegetative signs of what's going on. And sometimes it's hard for the person to verbalize. Other times they verbalize it all over the place. Now, vegetative signs that start to occur. A loss of appetite. And generally, I would guess maybe to some extent it's mind over matter, a general slowing down of some body processes, but the big one is the GI tract. Constipation becomes a very prominent issue. This may be associated with the loss of appetite. No roughage, if you will, equals no pooping. Okay, so that's another thing that happens. GI tract slows down, and nutrition starts to suffer. A loss of libido. Even sex doesn't interest. Sleep disturbances. We talked about sedative hypnotics. Sometimes, what's the best treatment of insomnia? An antidepressant. Okay? Will do wonders for the sleep cycle. Sleep disturbances of all kinds. Most commonly, I guess, would be maintenance issues. Inability to stay asleep for longer than a couple hours at a time. Okay? And finally, we start seeing signs of immune depression. Antibody titers start going down. People become more susceptible to viruses and other infections, those types of things. Those are the vegetative signs and symptoms that we can see. But primarily, depression is diagnosed through the non-vegetative signs, through analysis of a person's emotions and emotional ability. On the other hand, we have mania, and when I talk about bipolar disorder, I'll get into that more on Friday, but mania is just the opposite. Instead of going on a downward spiral, you're on an upward high, which can last for a couple, 3 days without sleep, without anything. It's just go, go, go. And we'll talk about that a little bit on Friday. But right now we're going to talk about, why have I got the pens there, I ask. The chemical control of depression. And notice the word I use. What did I say? Control. Now, understand that we may put a person on a chemical as an antidepressant. They'll be on it for 2 or 3 years. We slowly withdraw and wean them from it. And bingo, depression is gone. We probably haven't cured the depression. It got cured, but it was not with the drug we gave the individual. Okay? But always understand that that's a possibility. We are not necessarily going to be on these things for the rest of our life, as opposed to antipsychotics, where pretty much that's a given. You're going to have a lifetime. So let's go through the antidepressants. The first class of drugs, the oldest class, the first types of compounds that have been discovered to be useful in the treatment of depression are, I would assume you at least have briefly touched these earlier in the semester, the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, the MAO inhibitors. When we started looking at the metabolism, the degradation of epinephrine, And norepinephrine, we found two pathways, one of which was monoamine oxidase. We said, you know, maybe we can increase epi or norepi levels in peripheral synapses to therapeutic advantage. So we started looking at trying to inhibit the catabolism and found these drugs. And they became useful in depression. First of all, and while there's only one up there, there were three major ones that were marketed. First of all, understand that a good antidepressant has to get central. We had lots of MAO inhibitors developed, but only three of them got central to any great degree, where the action has to be if you're going to combat depression. And we now understand that probably what we're looking at is a disorder in and around the limbic system. So not only do they have to get central, but they have to get to this particular area of the CNS. The problem is that in order to get to this particular area of the CNS, we have to give them systemically. We don't yet have the sophistication to target the limbic system. We cannot bore a hole in the skull and put in a little tube and just administer it locally. And so a big issue with monoamine oxidase inhibition as an antidepressant was all sorts of peripheral systemic side effects, particularly cardiovascular issues, hypertensive crises, cardiac arrhythmias all over the map. And as a result, we started looking for a better mousetrap, that is, an alternative molecule to an MAO inhibitor that perhaps would more specifically target what's going on with depression. And at that time, we said to ourselves, well, MAO inhibitors increase catecholamines, particularly norepi and epi. So, simplistically, KISS type of philosophy, depression is not enough, norepi or epi. For some reason, you don't have the quantity you should. You get depressed. And how are we treating it? By taking low levels of these compounds and getting them back up to normal in and around the limbic system. So we were all about, at that point in time, what is known as the catecholamine theory of depression. And so the molecules we started looking at were molecules that in screens looked as if they were going to increase epi and norepinephrine levels in the brain. And one of the molecules then that was developed becomes known as the tricyclic antidepressant. Tricyclics. Now, listen, unless, just so you don't think too much of pharmaceutical science, developing the tricyclics was not rocket science. In fact, and I'll talk about this in a couple of days, the tricyclics are derived from this molecule, the phenothiazines. Remember, at this time, depression and the disorders of mood were not a separate category. They were lumped under the psychoses. Okay? We knew these were effective for treating psychotic activity. They didn't do squat for depression, by the way. But we said, well, maybe a similar molecule will work on depression. And so we started looking at all sorts of alternatives, and in fact, we developed what becomes known as the tricyclic type of antidepressant. And these are, there were about 8 to 10 of them that were originally developed. I'm not sure if I'll give you this or not, but I'll see if you get something like this in that cam. Typical price. Do you have this in your handout?
Okay.
Typical tricyclic. What a shock. 3 rings. Okay. And what comes off of the bottom end? A tail. So what am I looking at is a 4-letter word?
Kite.
Kite. Not shit. Kite. Okay. And in fact, as you may know by now, I don't know where you are, but again, a phenothiazine is the same structure with just a sulfur group right there. Okay? Basically. So it wasn't rocket science. We substitute either an ether bridge or a dicarbon bridge for a sulfur, and we got these new molecules, tricyclic antidepressants. As we'll discover when we talk about the phenothiazines, a big thing about kites is they are anti. And although it was somewhat of a surprise, it should not have been, that the tricyclics have a lot of the same side effect profile that phenothiazines do. They tend to be anti-muscarinic. They tend to be antihistaminic. They tend to be alpha, anti-alpha, adrenergic, alpha blockers. Okay, so they tend to be anti-compounds. Now, the tricyclics hit the market in about 1972 or 73. And they very quickly replace monoamineoxidase inhibition for the control of depression. By 1982, tricyclic antidepressant overdose, acute toxicity, becomes the fourth most common OD that we see in U.S. hospitals, statistically speaking, and trailed only, narcotic alcohol combinations as a cause of death from a chemical overdose. More deaths than amphetamine, more deaths than cocaine, more deaths than just about anything except for narcotic alcohol combo. Okay. Mortality rate, depending on the hospital you went to, was anywhere from 20 to 25%. These things have a fairly narrow therapeutic index. You know, I was going to try and press on through, but I'm going to just do this segue and then quit for the morning. The major issue that we'll talk about when we come in on Friday is cardiac. And we'll talk about how that develops. Cardiac issue. Heart failure with tricyclics. Fairly narrow therapeutic index. The other issue that we did not understand until the mid to late 80s is the fact that these compounds, because of the way they work, take about 10 days to 14 days before you see therapeutic efficacy. Are you with me? So typically, at least for the first decade or so, a patient would come in, would be diagnosed as suffering from clinical depression, and the physician would send them home with a 30-day supply of an antidepressant, and say, these should work. I mean, they're the hot new thing. It's going to do the job. Go to the pharmacist says, this is great stuff. Good luck. Person would go home, take them for 7 days, not see any effect, and of course, what is one of the major signs or symptoms of depression? Yeah, I'm such a loser that even this modern miracle drug can't help me. Well, screw it. How many have I got left? If one doesn't work, maybe 20 will. Or if they don't, the world's better off without me. Okay. So we gave them the gun to shoot themselves with, basically. And didn't tell them, didn't even know what we were doing. All right, we'll see you on Friday.